its benefits for all. In 1995, socialist organizations from various countries agreed to convene a conference to be held in South Africa this year. Between the 4th and 8th of December, delegates from 17 countries will gather in Cape Town to discuss the crisis of capitalism and the building of a socialist alternative. The conference has been organized by WOSA, the Workers' Organization for Socialist Action in South Africa, the Italian-based Socialismo Revolucionario, and the British Alliance for Workers' Liberty. But why was it decided to hold this conference in South Africa? I spoke to Neville Alexander, National Chairperson of WOSA.
The most important reason for holding the conference in South Africa is the belief which many progressive and radical socialists throughout the world have that South Africa is really, from the socialist point of view, a country of hope. It's still a country where the organized workers and even the unemployed do have some belief in and commitment to socialism. In other words, to an end to the capitalist system. And because of the aura around what people call the miracle of South Africa, it was felt that this is a very important climate to use in order to project the idea of an alternative society into the world at large.
And what will South Africans gain from this conference?
The most important thing, of course, is that we hope that South Africans will begin to understand that the problems that we face in this country are not unique to South Africa, that in fact the problems that we are grappling with are problems that are global, that are you find in every other country in the world, especially in the so-called third world, first of all. Secondly, that the notion which particularly government people are spreading, that there is no alternative to beer, there is no alternative to the economic and social strategies which the government has adopted, that notion is false. That is why we call it prepare the socialist alternative. We are basically saying that there is an alternative and that we need to explore what that alternative might be.
But what is wrong with the current political situation in South Africa? Many people hold forward positive examples of community RDP projects, of rural land reform and of Masakane. Neville Alexander again.
For very many of South Africa's people, specifically the black people of South Africa, the changeover that took place in 1994 has meant a lot. In other words, some people have gained. There's no question about that. First of all, all of us have got the franchise. We've got the right to vote. But as you know, the right to vote does not put food on your table, firstly. Secondly, we need to admit, and even government people admit this, that to deliver on the promises that were made in 1994 in regard to housing, education, healthcare, jobs, and so on, to deliver on all these promises is going to take a long, long time. And the reason is that the fundamental, the basic relationships of power have not changed. Take a simple example of the land. It's as true today as it was before 1994, that virtually all the arable land, the land on which you grow food in South Africa, virtually all that land is owned by 60,000 white farmers or companies. That hasn't changed. It means, in other words, that even though we've got a black government or a new government or a democratic government, call it what you will, even though we've got that, we've got new people in office, the fundamental relations of inequality are continue to be the same. That is why you can't be satisfied. Everybody knows that despite the new government, unemployment has not got better. On the contrary, it's got much worse. And I'm not blaming the government. I'm not saying it's the government's fault. It's not only the government's fault. It's the fault of an entire system. But the point I'm making is that there is no reason at all to feel that we're on the right road. If, in fact, almost half of the population that wants to work can't find work. We are sitting here as we're talking in a situation where teachers, something like 5,000 teachers are going to be thrown out of their jobs at the end of the year. In that sense, nothing has changed. And the few people who've got houses, the one or two communities where some land has been got, etc., that doesn't mean a thing when you look at the entire system, when you look at the system as a whole. And that is why we need to look at whether there are alternatives and what we need to do in order to promote those alternatives.
The alternative path proposed by Neville Alexander and his organization, the Workers' Organization for Socialist Action, is the path of socialism. But isn't socialism dead? Haven't we seen the failure of socialism in Eastern Europe?
Socialism is not dead. It's Stalinism that is dead. I think we must be very clear about that. The system that existed in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe and in other parts that called themselves socialist obviously tarnished the image, they blemished the image of socialism. People identified those systems with socialism. In actual fact, those were anti-working class, totalitarian systems which were really only benefited a certain layer of bureaucrats. People, what we would nowadays call upper middle class and sort of middle class people. Those were the only ones who really benefited from those systems, not the workers. So I want to stress the point, it is not socialism that is dead, it's Stalinism that is dead. Firstly. Secondly, the difference between socialism and capitalism is very simple. It's the difference between private ownership of means of production, like factories and shops and banks and whatnot, production, means of production and exchange, on the one hand, which is the capitalist system, and common ownership, people's ownership of those means of production. The reason why that is important is that you should not have a situation ever where one person or a small group of people have got the power of life and death, of giving you a job or not giving you a job, giving you a kidney dialysis or not giving you kidney dialysis, the power of life and death over millions of people, which is a situation under capitalism. It's the Raymond Ackermans, the Oppenheimers, the Ruperts, those are the people who control literally the lives of millions of South Africans. That system is capitalism. That is a system of individual enrichment, whereas the socialist system that we're talking about is one where all the people benefit from the investment which they make through the labor power into producing a social surplus, into producing, in other words, goods, services, and so on, from which everybody can benefit. Socialism, in other words, is a system of ownership, public ownership, and distribution such that all people have access to all the goods and services that are produced in the society. And you don't need to own money in order to have that access, which is the case under capitalism.
WOSA is not the only organization involved in the International Socialist Conference. Up to 8 South African-based and 10 foreign socialist organizations will be attending. The basis for participation is the acceptance of a base document which outlines conference aims.
The point about the base document is that we simply said, look, we don't want any sectarianism. We don't want people to come to a conference like that and think that they've got the final answer. They've got the only way to the truth. A sort of cultic, sectarian attitude. We don't want that. We want people to come, share their experiences, share their points of view, and then create a network, not a world party. We don't believe in world parties. The world is much too complex for world parties and homogenous, standardized ways of thinking and ways of seeing things. We don't believe in that. We're saying, let's see how we can coordinate our actions. Let's see whether we can undertake joint projects, campaigns, for example, against gender discrimination, against racism, against unemployment, etc. Can we do this? How can we do this? We don't need to have the same ideological positions on all these things. And I think a lot of organizations have got problems with that. Our fundamental line of difference with the Communist Party and other groups as well is that we insist that it must be revolutionary socialist. We don't want groups that basically compromise with the capitalist system, like social democrats or liberals. Mm-hmm. We want people to say very clearly that we take a stand on capitalism, we oppose capitalism, we want a socialist alternative.
The conference will focus on issues which include racism, globalization, environmental issues, the campaign against the IMF and World Bank, and working class struggle. Also to be discussed are gender issues and AIDS.
The hold of patriarchy, the hold of the male dominance in society generally, across the centuries, across the epochs of production, that hold is even stronger in a way than the hold of the capitalist system. And the backwardness, if I can call it that, of men is an attested fact of history. In other words, men have used whatever advantages they've had throughout the history of the world in order to oppress and instrumentalize women and even children. We cannot say, I don't think anybody can say, that there's a magic formula which socialists have. We're going to have to explore again the best ways, and the feminist movement here has been very instructive and has taken a leading role in instructing us how to handle the matter. So socialists have to learn from feminists, they have to learn from ecologists, they have to learn from health workers how to attack some of these problems. What we do believe, and this I don't think is a utopian approach, what we do believe is that because there are no vested interests in a socialist society that is organized on socialist principles, because there are no vested interests, profit interests for example, it is more likely that solutions to these problems can be found in such society than in a society where, let's say, pharmaceutical firms, for example, may not want certain cures for AIDS, let's say, to be promoted because they would be the losers. I mean, you know, there's now a debate going on in South Africa about this. Certain pharmaceutical firms would be the losers if certain types of drugs were promoted. Now, in a social society, that sort of stuff would be the stuff of public debate. It wouldn't be something that would be controlled by vested interests. And similarly with gender issues, we would make those things as public as possible, you know. And that is why I feel quite strongly that within that framework, it is more likely that you will find approaches that will lead to solutions in both individual and even in social cases. I don't think there's a magic formula, and I think any socialist or Marxist who maintains that he or she has got the answer to all the problems of the world is just talking nonsense.
Neville Alexander, National Chairperson of the Workers' Organization for Socialist Action. The International Socialist Conference will be opened at a public meeting at Community House in Salt River on Thursday, the 4th of December at 7 p.m. The main speaker will be Osmarino, the leader of the rural workers in the Brazilian province of Amazonia. On Saturday the 6th, a cultural program will take place at the Balville College of Education in Curls River, and on Sunday the 7th at 6:30, you can attend a talk on land, liberty and women's emancipation to be held at the Mowbray Town Hall. For further information, contact the WOSA office on 476-839, that's 476-839, or visit them at Community House, Salt River.
First of all, Osmarino, I want to thank Bush Radio and to say that he's very glad to be here to speak to the South African population. One of the reasons of our coming here is the development of the capitalist system. It is more and more imposing a very violent politics in Brazil, but I think also here in Africa. So, for example, today, in the Amazon forest, that is one of the biggest rain tropical forests of the world, and in this forest now there are developing projects to exploit more and more the forest just to gain immediate profits without plan and without think how is the future for the people living there, how the future of the nature there. So the concrete day-to-day politics of economy and capitalism is clearly destroying the life of million people there.
Has it gotten any better since Chico Mendes was so brutally murdered by the land grabbers in December 1988? Has it gotten any better? As Osmarino Amancio replaced Chico Mendes as the leader of this group. Now, has things gotten any better in this time since 1988 in his leadership?
The violence in the rural area of Brazil grew very much in these years after the killing.
It got worse?
Yes, worse and worse. Because until some time ago, we were facing in our struggle only the land owners, the big farmers. Now we are to confronting also the same structure of the state that through the police and the army are
they're joined forces.
Yes, and
with the landowners.
Yes, and they are daily confronting the movement of the landless, the workers of the forest, and the indigenous tribes of the forest. For example, just last year, in the state of Pará, one of the rural states of Brazil, the police, a contingent of 150 policemen, attacked a demonstration, an occupation of the land organized by the landless workers, and they killed 18 people, and they wounded, injured other 60 rural workers.
I suppose the murderers were never found.
No, lá no Brasil, quem manda mais?
Yes, it's true. There in Brazil, who order the killings never went to jail.
The killers of Chico Mendes escaped from jail after only a few years. Have they ever been found?
É, foi pego um, mas é importante lembrar que o que foi preso.
What happened that only one of the killers was captain put in jail, but all the people that organized this crime never
went to trial.
Yes.
Now, in Brazil, the problem is the rainforests are being burnt down for grazing land, for lumber, whatever. But how is the struggle different in Italy? You don't have the same, you don't have the same, you don't have rainforest in Italy. How are the workers deprived and oppressed in Italy?
Sure, the situation of Italy is completely different. We can see it also by the fact that, for example, in Brazil, we can find some big multinational controlled by big Italian bosses, like Pirelli, like Fiat, that now is intervening there. But also the situation
how
of...
How is Fiat intervening?
They are buying land. They are intervening because, you know, they are they produce cars, but they are interest in very
anything
different interests.
Anything
yes,
that will make
any
money.
Kind of production. So we are sure that also Italian companies are involved. This is one first example of the tie that there is among different countries. But I think also from the point of view of the interest of the workers, we can find in a different situation common elements. For example, in Italy in the last years, many of the achievement of the workers' movement, for example, social security, pension, health care, and so on, was cut, like in all the European countries, in the name of the building of the United Europe, the Maastricht Treaty.
Mm-hmm.
This means for the majority of the European population and for the workers, worst condition in every workplace and in the so-called social state. All the social expenses were cut every year more and more. The other big problem is unemployment. In my country, the situation is very difficult in the south of the country, that is less developed and where there is a rate of 30% of unemployment among the active population, and among youth is higher, 40-45, in the south of Italy. In the north, we can say that there is full employment.
So Napoli, that area, Firenze, Roma, is okay, but up north?
Yes, for example, Napoli, in the south,
yes.
Sicily,
Brindisi,
and so on. Then there is a third important phenomena that is something new for Italy, that is a very massive immigration in the last 10 years, but
from
it's growing
where?
And
from
growing.
Where?
From all over the world, but the biggest communities that now live in Italy, new workers that are living in Italy, are from North Africa, the Maghreb, from Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia,
yeah.
But also from Western Africa, Senegal, Ivory Coast.
But they weren't former colonial Italian colonies, right?
No.
Africa.
Yes.
North Africa, I understand. Libya and...
You know, for
Morocco.
This reason, in Italy, we hadn't important immigrant community till 10 years ago. But now there is something new, a world phenomenon of big migration. For example, Italy never had colonies in Far East, but now there are thousands and a dozen of thousands of Filipino people, Pakistan people, Bangladesh people coming to Italy.
Vietnamese?
Very
South,
few.
Not many from Southeast Asia.
The most from the Indian subcontinent, Sri Lanka too, from Philippines.
Is it because these very big multinationals have it made it difficult for these people to earn a living in their own home,
yes,
in their own country?
They are forced to escape from the country looking for a job somewhere else. And Italy is one of the countries where there is a need for the bosses of cheap labor. So they are coming and coming. And we are struggling very much trying to build a unity between Italian workers and immigrant workers.
And that must be very difficult.
Well, we are facing difficulties because it's sure that the Italian state, the Italian regime want to divide the workers. But in the last 2 years we had some important results, something completely new for our country. Last year there was a very big national demonstration in Rome, 50,000 people that gathered in Rome to protest against the government and defending the rights of the immigrants. The large majority were immigrant workers, not Italian. Last May Day we organized with a anti-racist association a May Day demonstration, always in Rome, opposing the government and the racist laws, and 10,000 people was there. This time the large majority were not Italian workers but immigrant workers. So the workers movement is changing. You're no more an Italian but a multi-ethnical.
Osmar, you know, you have, yes, you have the land problem. Is it very difficult to organize opposition to this land grab in Brazil?
Yes, it's very difficult to organize the struggle. All the leading members of the trade unions in the rural areas, they have a very dangerous life. My case, for example, I cannot walk alone. I cannot sleep in the same house every night. I have 20 hours per day security, bodyguards that are comrades of the movement to protect me, because I received already several attacks, attempt to kill me, and I have already lost a lot of my comrades, not only Chico Mendes, but many other were killed. So this is a very deep difficulties for us. In the same time, the country is very big, you know. There are 8 million square kilometers of land that are owned by very few people.
Yes, the land grab is one thing, but we have the same problem with multinationals wanting cheap labor in the urban areas.
Lá é muito violento, né?
Well, in Brazil and in the Amazon, multinational companies and conglomerates are one of the our worst enemy, because they are coming to the forest. They are intervening in the forest. Multinationals from Germany, Europe, from Asia, from Japan, to exploit the richness of the forest. They are big company for the exploitation of wood, but also a company involved in the exploitation of minerals like gold, research for oil and so on. Last year they inverted something like $300 million to organize the exploitation of new parts of the Amazon. So for us is really the enemy number one. Yes, and this is one of the reasons of our coming here to the International Conference of Socialists, because we want to build ties, links, solidarity with the workers of other countries. In our struggle, we always in the past supported the South African people's struggle. We know that you had to face a very strong enemy. We know that there is also, in a different way, a land problem here. So we think that this conference is an opportunity to gather the people that want a different war, a world in which we can build solidarity and we can have no unemployment,
yes,
and struggle together again.
That was Bush Radio's reporter Zain Ibrahim in conversation with Paolo Damiani from Italy. And as Marina Amancio, who is the leader of the rural workers in the Amazon forest in Brazil, they just left Cape Town. In fact, they've been here for a conference, the International Socialist Conference, and well, I think it certainly was quite interesting and we were honored to have them in our studio. If you'd like more information, you can call me after the program at 448-5450. Listening to Backchat on Bush Radio on 89.5 FM. Still to come, we're going to have the African news in a few minutes time, and after that I'll be chatting to Gabrielle, the coordinator of Media Watch, and she'll be telling
people NBC have been on crossfire twice. Horrible, horrible. You sit there and you got one right winger here, it was Robert Novak and Reed Irvine of AIM here, and they're screaming at you, both of them shouting, and you can't finish a sentence. I remember turning to Novak, I said, is this a screaming match, or are you going to let me finish a sentence? We'll let you finish a sentence, but first we have to break for a commercial. And and that's the way it is.
You are listening to author and political analyst Michael Parenti on Inventing Reality, the Politics of the News Media. At the end of the program, there will be information on how to obtain a copy of this talk.
When I wrote Inventing Reality, the National Enquirer, my Andy Warhol one moment of total national media glory, the National Enquirer, you know the rag that you see the supermarkets? He calls me up and the guy says, Mr. Parenti, we want to do a story on you and your book, Inventing Reality. I said, in the National Enquirer? I say, hello? He says, yes, could you tell us this? And the kind of questions he's asking, it's very interesting, you know, you're sort of caught, you have to give the interview. I said, you know, I don't want to talk to you. I know what you're going to come up with. He says, well, if you talk to me or don't talk to me, we're going to come up with it anyway. And he says, and so you might as well be able to try to get your 2 cents in, you know? So, you know, they got you hooked. So you say, no, that's not what happened. That isn't what I said. This is what I said. No. Well, it finally came out in the National Enquirer, and it was a whole half a page. The bottom half was ads, and it was a whole half a page, and it said, professors teach hatred of America. All right, my jaw dropped, and there were 2 pictures there. A picture of me and a picture of Karl Marx, both of us next to each other. And then there was a graphic on the other side of the picture. The graphic consisted of an outline map of the United States, just an outline, and across the middle of it was a sickle cutting through with drops of blood dripping like that. Subtle, subtle. So sometimes people, in my opinion, do get exposure in the media. Don't want to overstate it. The outcome is that you have a media that has a very pro-business bias. What's good for business is generally thought of as good for America. Alternative policies and approaches are seldom discussed and debated. There are all sorts of feelings in a democracy where the average citizen does not own a radio station or a TV station. Mass demonstrations, feelings, sentiments of these sorts become the creative impetus for democracy. There are a feedback, there are a way that citizens can feedback and tell their government that enough is enough here, or we want more of that, and the other thing. Many of those kinds of protests are blacked out of the media. They're simply not allowed in. The media are generally anti-labor, non-existent. Labor is almost non-existent. U.S. interventionism abroad, almost always supported, unless opinion turns sharply, unless American lives are being lost, and the objective isn't being quickly done. We see that kind of racism, ethnocentrism right now in the national discussion on Somalia. 18 U.S. Rangers were killed, 78 wounded in one fight, and suddenly 18 American lives become the most important thing that exists. No word, no debate, ever about the over 1,000 Somalians who've been killed. The official figure is like 300 and something. We now know that the Belgian paratroopers massacred 200 Somalians just a few weeks ago, and it was all covered up. There have been many of them killed. The head of the military mission, David Stockwell, is saying things like, in that one demonstration, he said the women and children were endangering the lives of the UN troops. That's why we shot at them. They were committing acts of violence or shooting at the UN troops. It's kind of disgusting. Even when there is debate about interventionist policy, what's left unexamined is whether or not that policy really is coming from good intentions. The regular demonizing of foreign leaders. I mean, in Vietnam, the debate was between those who said we can win in Vietnam and those who said we can't win, so let's get out. There was no debate about all the other people, the millions of us who were marching and saying, we shouldn't win. We shouldn't even be fighting. We should allow that country to develop in its own ways, make its own mistakes. And there's nothing you have that's so precious and so great that justifies your going in there and saturation bombing with B-52s and burning villages and killing men, women, and children at the rate that you're doing and spraying that country with dioxide and Agent Orange and destroying its ecology and wreaking that kind of havoc and murder and slaughter. There's nothing you have. No refrigerators, no General Motor cars, no great free enterprise system that you have that's so magnificent that justifies your doing that to those people. That opinion never got on the air. That opinion that we shouldn't be in the war because it was a wrong war and an immoral war was never debated. The debate was always over tactical things. We're losing too many American lives. It's too costly. It was well-intentioned, but it went awry.